Imagine your friend invites you to a party. You arrive and there's lots of people, decorations, food and drink. There's enough for everyone.
When you're hosted by someone that generous, you don't have to worry about your needs. You can just enjoy yourself and focus on the people around you.
Yeah, that's what a good host wants for her guests.
And this is the picture of the world that we find in the Bible. Creation is an expression of God's generous love. He's the host, and humans are his guests in a world of opportunity and abundance.
And we're called to keep the party going, to spread his goodness. This is a beautiful picture. But it's not the way people experience the world. Rather, we find a world of scarcity and struggle, not abundance.
And Jesus grew up in that kind of world. Under military occupation, people losing their land or families to debt and poverty. And yet, he would say things like this. Look at the birds. They don't store up food for themselves, yet they have enough. Or consider the wildflowers. They're beautiful and abundant, and they don't stress about their existence. And you all should live that way, too.
But surely Jesus knew that things don't always work out. I mean, sometimes there really isn't enough.
And Jesus did experience poverty firsthand, but he viewed the world through the story of the Hebrew Scriptures, which claimed that our scarcity problem isn't caused by a lack of resources. Rather, the problem is our mindset that God can't be trusted.
Maybe God's holding out on me. Maybe there isn't enough, and maybe I need to take matters into my own hands.
And once we're deceived into that mindset of scarcity, we can justify the impulse to take care of me and mine before anyone else.
I'm going to start by reminding you, we're asking you to turn in your pledge cards today during the offertory. So if you haven't filled one out already, if you don't have it with you, there's still some out here. You have time after the sermon to go out and grab one and fill it out. Friends, I'm going to read to you out of Luke chapter 16, verses 1 through 13. He also said to the disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be the manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' And so, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' He said, 100 measures of oil. He said to him, 'Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, 'And how much do you owe?' And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Friends, this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. This is probably one of the most confusing parables in the entire gospel, right? Because it seems on the surface like Jesus is commending someone for lying and cheating and stealing, and then telling the disciples, you should kind of be like him, but not really. So a couple of things I want to point out just linguistically. This translation says manager. NIV says manager. All the modern translations say manager, but if you go back to the Revised Standard Version from the 50s and anything older, he's called a steward. And what's taken from him is the stewardship. So it does tie into a stewardship sermon series quite nicely. Thank you very much. And the word that's translated as unrighteous wealth later on when he talks about making friends for yourself by unrighteous wealth It's not a word that means like money you have gained dishonestly. It's just a word that refers to worldly possessions, right? It's unrighteous because it's not eternal. That's all it means. So that helps you get a little bit better sense of what he's saying. But let's talk about the parable for a minute. So you have this manager, a steward, right? He works for a very rich man. And the way this system worked in the ancient world is you had very wealthy people who owned a lot of land. People rented the land from them to grow olives, wheat, whatever produce, right? Graze their livestock, whatever they're doing with the land. And at the end of the harvest season, that's when they pay their rent, which is a percentage of whatever goods they produce. And Jewish people were not allowed to charge interest on money, but they could charge interest on goods. So it's not uncommon for a very wealthy person who has to have a manager to manage his household and manage all his lands and manage his business to skim some money off the top in the form of interest that the actual owner of the land doesn't know anything about. Because he handles all the billing, right? The manager handles the bills. He gives the bills to the clients. Everyone trusts that he's doing the right thing. It's not hard for him to just mark down that they owe a bit more in their payment than what they really do. So he's been dishonest, right? He's been embezzling funds for all intents and purposes. And someone reports this to the landowner. And right off the bat, we learn something really important about this master. Because the thing is, he would have been well within his rights to take this dishonest manager, have him thrown in prison, and sold his children into slavery to pay the debt. That was kind of how they normally did things. If you owed a debt and couldn't pay it, you're in prison until you do. It's the number one way people end up in slavery in the Roman Empire is as payment of a debt. But all he does is say, you're fired. So we learn right off the bat that this particular landowner, this master, is very merciful with his people. And then the steward has this actually kind of deviously brilliant plan. He's going to try and do two things at the same time. First, he's going to try and make it impossible for his master to actually fire him. And as he's doing that, he's also going to work his way into the good graces of all the tenants who owe his master money. So what he does is he goes to them, right? He's got this opportunity. He's supposed to get the books together to turn into the master. And as he's supposed to be doing that, he goes to all the debtors and tells them to alter their bill, right? He tells them to do it so it's not his handwriting on the bill. So he's not implicated. But he tells them to lower their debt. And to give you an idea of what's going on here, okay, 100 measures of oil is about 875 gallons of oil. It takes about 150 olive trees to make that much oil, which is a lot of olive trees. Okay? The wheat, again, 100 measures of wheat, that is somewhere between 1,000 and 1,200 bushels, or roughly 37,000 to 45,000 liter jars full of wheat. It's equivalent to 150 acres of wheat. So these tenants who are renting land from his master are actually extremely wealthy people in their own right. The kind of people who would need a manager to manage their households. He's making himself look good to them so that if he does need a job, all these people will have just seen, hey, we like him. He helped us out. But what he's really doing, the main goal, like that's the fallback. The main goal is to make it impossible for the master to fire him, because here's what happens in the ancient world. It's not uncommon for very wealthy landowners to forgive portions of their tenants' debt during hard times to make themselves look good, to give them the air of benevolence. No one knows that this steward has been fired yet. Everyone he's talking to thinks that his master has authorized him to go and reduce the amount of debt. And now if his master fires him, everyone will assume he got fired for doing something kind and benevolent. He's made it like a PR nightmare for him to lose his job. That's really what he's done, right? He's been, and you have to understand, ancient stories like this, they kind of praise cunning and deviousness as a virtue unto itself pretty commonly. But I want you to notice that Jesus does not praise him for lying and cheating and stealing. He praises him for his shrewdness and his perception. He's picked up on a couple of things. He has figured out, because of the fact that his master didn't fire him and sell his kids into slavery, that mercy and generosity are actually core to who his master is. Which means his master is going to want people to see him as merciful and kind and generous, and people won't be surprised if his master is merciful and kind and generous. But he's also figured out that he can use the wealth he has access to for better purposes than just enriching himself. And what Jesus is kind of saying, there's an element of, you know, he uses this phrase in parables all the time, and it's implied here, but how much more, right? In other words, if this dishonest cheat can figure out how to use wealth for a higher purpose, how much more should the people who actually serve the Lord with integrity and genuineness figure out what the purpose of all the wealth they have been given is actually meant to be? It's a weird example, but he's trying to tear down his listeners' perceptions of the world around them. And he explains it a bit here at the end, right? Make friends for yourselves by means of all these possessions. In other words, use your possessions, the wealth that's been given to you, to serve others. In the understanding that the relationships you build with the people you serve through your possessions, those are eternal. But the wealth and the possessions you have are not. Use these temporary things God has given you for eternal purposes. Right? And if even that dishonest manager can figure out how to make his wealth serve him in a way that's better than just filling his own pockets, you ought to be able to do so much more than he ever could. That's the point. You, as God's people, ought to have a much better understanding than he would of how to take your God-given wealth, whatever it may be, and use it for a higher purpose. Excuse me. Right? And then he has this lovely bit, right? One who's faithful in very little is faithful in much. If you've not been faithful, who will entrust you to the true riches? I said last week, you know, this life, really, so much of what we are called to do in the here and now is meant to be training for eternity. My daughter likes to help us cook. Now, she's 4, so you can imagine how helpful that actually is. But she has, like, a little wooden stool that gets her up to the level of the counter. And she'll push it into the kitchen and climb up and put on a little apron, because she has a little apron, and ask to help cook. Which always fills me with dread. But she has a little set of, like, plastic toy kitchen knives, right? And they're plastic, but they actually work for cutting a lot of food. You can use them. So we'll hand her something. We'll hand her, like, an avocado, and she can slice it. She cut potatoes the other day. It took forever. You know, if you ever tried to cut a potato with a plastic knife, I don't recommend it. She's getting all her weight on the, you know, pushing it down. But she cut the potatoes for dinner that night with her little plastic knife, right? Now, we do that because cooking is one of those skills that most people ought to have some ability in just to function in the world, right? You need to be able to prepare some amount of food for yourself. So it's good for her to learn that, but we're not going to hand her a real knife yet because, well, she's 4, right? If she gets a real knife, she's going to hurt somebody, and it's probably going to be Daddy. Because that's just how it always goes, right? They never hurt themselves. They hurt Dad. So we're not going to give her a real kitchen knife. We'll give her something that she can learn on that's safe. And when she's mastered that, then she can use the real thing. Everything that we have in this life, all our wealth, all our possessions, whether it's a lot or a little, everything we have is on loan from God. None of it is ours. None of it is permanent. We are not entitled to a single cent of it. It belongs to God. We are merely the managers. And we will be called to account for how we have managed the Lord's possessions. That's a theme that runs through the Bible from page 1 all the way to the end. You can't get away from it. Everything we have is his. We manage it. And the implication of what Jesus says here is that we manage it specifically because the true riches are yet to come. And if we can't learn to manage what God gives us in this life to His glory, we will really struggle with the real thing. We've been given what we have been given so that we can learn to live in God's kingdom one day. And if God can't trust us with what we have now, then how could He trust us with the true riches? See, what happens when we fail to use what God has given us as He intends it, when we start treating it as if it belongs to us and not to Him, we think we're serving ourselves. Right? We think we are doing this all for ourselves. We think that we are making those decisions under our own ability. We think we're doing this for our benefit. But the reality is, once we start doing that, we have chained ourselves to a master. Our wealth and our possessions have become our masters, and they govern us. And they fill us with fear and with greed and with selfishness. It becomes an idol. And it is and always has been one of the greatest idols that mankind has had to deal with. Because it's subtle. It can get its hooks into you without you ever noticing. Because it can be used for things that are obviously and objectively good. You need to feed your family. You need to give your family shelter. You want to buy good things for the people you love. Those of us who have kids want to provide a good future for our kids, both while we're alive and when we're gone. All of that's good stuff. And therein lies the danger. Because if you stop viewing it as God's possessions that you are merely managing, if you begin viewing it as yours to do with as you see fit, yours that you are entitled to, yours that you are in control of, it's already won. And now your possessions and your wealth are ruling over you. This is why Jesus says you can't do both. You can't serve two masters. You're going to be serving one or the other. The way you break the hold that it can have over you is generosity. And that doesn't mean just giving to the church, right? I'm not trying to just say give all your money to the church and the Lord will take care of you, it'll be good. Because generosity affects every aspect of your life. Christians are supposed to be marked out specifically by their generosity. For the first 300 years of the church, the one thing that everyone knew Christians did was take care of other people. You see it in the writings that Roman governors send back to the emperor to explain what's going on with these weird cult people in their cities. They're flabbergasted that they're taking care of the poor and feeding them meals and caring for the sick out of their own pocket. They can't comprehend why they're doing it. The answer is because they're serving God. It's not just that they were giving money to the church. I mean, please do it. It's that they understood that their calling as followers of Jesus was to be radically generous every single day in every aspect of their lives. In our own history as Methodists, John Wesley reclaimed that idea, right? I mean, you recall when he starts the Methodist movement, they were not a separate church. They didn't have their own church buildings to meet in. They still went and worshiped at Church of England churches on Sunday, but they met in small groups during the week, and he made sure that their small groups took up a collection that was separate from their Sunday morning tithes so that they could distribute the money to the poor. Part of the reason why John Wesley died without literally a penny to his name is because he gave all his money away. And people have done the math, and if he had actually kept the profits from all of the things he published and the tracts that he sold, he could have been one of the wealthiest men in England. And he gave it all away so that people would be cared for and fed and treated while they were sick. And one of the things I love about this church is that that is in fact already part of our identity. money from the pumpkin patch is going to go to feed people. You know, when we had VBS earlier this year, we raised money for the Coastal Bend Food Bank. That money provided 1,600 meals. That was kids doing that. 1,600 meals. This is already part of who we are. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I'm just reminding you that the reason why we give is not just because we want to keep the lights on in the church. It's not just because we want to make sure that we pay the insurance bills and that the building is here. It's because God calls his people to be so generous every day of their lives with everyone they meet that when people hear the word Christian, they think generosity. You want to talk about sharing your faith beyond the walls. Not everyone is called to go and preach the gospel out there. In fact, most of you probably aren't, which is why the idea of doing that fills a lot of you with dread. But what better way to share your faith than being generous, providing a meal, explaining to someone that the reason you're doing that is because you are a Christian and God's called you to be generous. This is why we give. It's not about the practical needs of the church. It's about recognizing that everything we have is God's already. We are called to manage it for him, not for us. And what he has called us to do with it, what he has, in fact, commanded us to do with it, is to be generous with it. In the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.